Unlabeled Leadership is a volunteer service. We appreciate our guests for their stewardship and remarkable stories. We also appreciate listeners like you who back the show with star reviews and contributions.
Gary DePaul with Season 3 of the Unlabeled Leadership Podcast. Welcome to Episode 155, Celine Schillinger co-creates with a social movement perspective. Here's a shout out to listeners in the greater Accra region in Ghana, Flanders, Belgium, Lakava, Lativa, Odessa, Ukraine, and in the United States, the Bronx, New York, Greenville, North Carolina, Salem, Oregon, and New Haven, Vermont. Here's a special shout out to Ronald Graves, who has been my leadership and business coach for now 3 years. Thank you, Ronald, for all the help you've provided. With that, let's get started. Celine Schillinger is a speaker, podcaster, and the author of the book, Dare to Unlead. A native of France, Celine has worked in Vietnam, Southeast Asia, China, Latin America, Africa, Japan, and the United States. She has spoken at several organizations and conferences about her expertise in organizational change, team efficiency, and engagement leadership. On her LinkedIn page, she has some recommendations. Here's one of them. Celine has an uncanny knack of seeing solutions in difficult situations and adversities. She is a humble leader with a kind heart and a role model displaying diversity and inclusion in the way she conducts herself. She has been a professional, a mentor, and a friend in my professional journey. Part 1, A Letter to the CEO. In my books, I write about 7 leadership principles. One of them is called Connect with Others. In this story, Celine illustrates a unique way in which she connected to several people through a social movement. Here's Celine to explain.
The context takes place at work. In 2010, I was working in a large company, a large pharmaceutical company. I had been there for 10 years already. Prior to that, I had been working 10 years in smaller size companies, mostly in Asia Pacific. So I joined this big company and enjoyed it a lot, but then progressively started to feel the weight, the heaviness of this, you know, large established structure. The way we worked felt like a constraint and very conservative and quite limiting. In 2010, I launched, a little bit by chance, something that became a movement, an employee movement in the workplace. I started by actually sending a letter to the CEO to suggest solutions to improve the diversity in our company, because I felt if we were able to reflect better the diversity of our customers, we would be better able to relate to them and to serve them with good products, good services, and so on. I sent this letter, and this letter became viral in the company, not through the CEO, but because I had forwarded it to 2-3 friends of mine. It really sparked a movement that grew bigger and bigger every day, up to almost 3,000 people across 50 countries. It was pretty amazing to see this movement of people eager to contribute, not to protest or fight against something, but to contribute. To me, it was really an aha moment. I realized there was all this energy, this passion, was this engagement. It was already there. There were, you know, colleagues, but yet I had never seen it in express show up in the workplace this way. And I thought there is here a potential, an untapped potential of energy, of engagement. And it would be wonderful. It would be amazing if we could put that energy in service of business goals, of business related purposes. And that became my engagement. Because of this movement and this opening to a new way, new possibilities, and because this connected around the internal social network, I opened up, or my interest grew around external social networks. I joined Twitter and other networks. I stumbled upon a woman named Helen Beaven, working at the NHS in England. And I discovered that Helen had been working for a long time on social movements and what organizations can learn from social movements. I stumbled upon one sentence, she said in an interview, that really struck me and that keeps striking me till today, almost 10 years later. Her sentence was, "We need to strategize change from a social movement perspective." I was like, whoa, yes, exactly. She's expressed in such a short sentence something that rings so true, that resonated so deeply with my own experience, this first activism experience in the workplace, that I felt there was potential for me to keep on exploring, discovering, and building value. I sincerely believe that this is a new value creation strategy, strategizing change from a social movement perspective. From that moment on, I kept, well, interacting with her and with people who gravitate around her and reflect on those kind of topics. I managed to get to meet Helen Vivian in person. She's really absolutely terrific. She's very active still to this date on Twitter and on other networks. I'm very grateful. It has been a very, very important encounter in my professional life, but I would say more than that, because my profession is my passion. It has become my mission almost, I would say.
Your story, the way it began with a letter, it sparked something external because you sent it to some friends, and internal within the company. It reminded me of potential and kinetic energy. What I mean by that, within the pharmaceutical business, there is sitting there a potential culture waiting to happen. What I mean by that is individuals, employees would love to have some type of a change, but they don't see it happening. There's just nothing to spark it. There may be something dissatisfied with how things are going, but they just live with it. It's just inertia. You just keep going the way you're going. But it sounds like you are able to change that potential energy and made it kinetic, and just instilling it within the company. It sounds like it's something that had a positive effect on the culture, if not within the company, but within the social environment around the company.
I totally agree. I think it's not limited to the pharma business.
Yeah.
It's everywhere in large, especially in large organizations, I would say. Because they are large and complex, have tried over the years, over the last decade, actually since Ford and Taylor, have tried to organize and maybe over-organize their activity, their operations, to such extent that people feel disempowered. They feel transformed into robots in a way, you know, by everything is so processed and segmented, and you need to ask permission from like three or four layers before you can do anything. It's extremely slow, it's complex, and it's not very joyful, honestly. The way these organizations work is kind of sucking the soul out of people and taking away what makes them humans in a way. It takes away our energy. It takes away our freedom. It takes away our enthusiasm, really. You know, the young generations are coming to work with a lot of ideals and energy and willingness. And then they feel pretty quickly, they realize that, well, no, that the corporate culture expects them to conform to a pretty limiting, you know, set of behaviors and attitudes. And that's why burnouts are on the rise enormously. Recent studies show that about 28% of millennials suffer burnout in the workplace, compared to 21% in the elder generations, which is already enormous. It's way too high. We don't leverage potential enough. We waste human capability. It's to me, it's a shame from a social perspective, but also from an economical, from a business perspective. We hire great people, you know, there's a war for talents, and we do everything it takes to get the brightest and the greatest in our workplaces. But then we treat them like children. We create, you know, endless layers of bosses, one on top of each other. Then we create internal competition for resources, for power. So, of course, it's not just that, you know, the work can be a great source of pleasure, and it's a source of financial means and social recognition. So it's not all bad, but it could be so much better, really.
when people come into an organization, you said they come in with ideals and excitement and energy, but then they feel the constraint that's placed upon them by the structure. The way you describe, you need approvals from three up, and you know, it sounds very much like the military in the US, that you can't do anything without multiple approvals. With that in mind, it seems that there's a few things happening, from my perspective at least, that there's real constraints from the structure, but then there's self-imposed constraints.
Yes.
Or manager imposed constraints. With that, managers could allow more flexibility for people to be creative and innovative, but they may feel the pressure of the constraints. And also with the employees, they become hesitant to do anything. It's easier and safer to be told what to do than to be told, this is where we need to get to. It's up to you to decide how we get there.
Yes, absolutely. There's also a lot to unpack in what you just said.
We should write a book.
Yeah, good idea. There's one coming. The one thing is that I think is super important in what you just said is that it's not just on managers' shoulders to change that. We are all responsible. We are self-limiting as well. It's a little bit easy to blame managers or to Yes. blame the culture or to blame the leaders or to blame, you know, we are the leaders. We are the culture. The culture is us. It's the people. It's what patterns of behaviors do we accept? Do we reproduce? What do we maintain without even seeing it? I sometimes come up with this example I heard just a few months ago, and it was striking to me. I talked with a team at a large organization, which was very interested in self-organization. You know, they wanted to develop self-organizing patterns and you know, ways of working in their organization. And so we had a chat and it was great. And they were super interested. And how do we do that? Blah, blah, blah. And then at the end, I asked them, so what are you going to do now? You know, what's your next step? And they said, well, we're going to write a report and submit it to our manager for approval. You see, this is, and they were not aware until I pointed out that of the contradiction they were carrying themselves. Once they saw it, well, then they got stuck. It was quite impressive for me to see that they were not able to overcome this, because it's quite, again, it's easy to have somebody to blame or something to blame, because then you don't need to take action.
Yeah.
So, and in organizations, I find the blame game is something that is pretty prevalent and that maintains the status quo very much. Everybody blames each other. R&D will blame production will blame marketing. The higher up will blame people lower down, and people lower down will blame the higher ups, or will blame the shareholders, whatever. If we can find somebody to blame, then we're good, you know, because we're not responsible for anything.
It's that blame that keeps people like me employed,
mm-hmm.
because they don't know how to handle it.
Mm.
They see symptoms, false attributions happen where they observe something, they interpret it, and then they react to the interpretation instead of the observation. There's a lot of symptoms that are identified, but not root causes.
Mm.
It takes people who are performance specialists to come in and really get at the root problems that are going on in the organization. Organizations are really complex.
Mm.
Underneath the hood, that's an American phrase. You look at a car and you see it's a car.
Mm.
On the outside, it might look completely different from another car and so on. But when you open the hood, there are similar features. And within organizations, there's a similar anatomy. Human bodies, it's like we have a nervous system. We have a muscular system, skeletal system that are similar. But on the outside, we look so much different.
Mm.
The things that you're identifying really capture some of the shared problems that many organizations and larger organizations experience.
And they stem at the origin of so many failed change initiatives, because change initiatives are about changing other people.
Yes.
And it can't work. Instead of how can we change them? How can we make them more of this or less of that? The right question to ask, in my opinion, is what can we do together?
You're right. It's about changing either processes, products, or people and how they work. And it's about changing them versus work.
Exactly. No, and the more you want to change people, the more you try, the harder you try, the more resistance you get, because people don't want to get changed. Do you want to get changed by other people? No. You want to be respected. You want to be listened to. You want to be invited. It's a very different kind of energy.
I'd like to ask you about that letter that sparked this multiple doors of opportunities, I guess is a way of phrasing it. Mm. The content was about improving diversity.
Yes.
If you don't mind, just share a little bit about what you were trying to express.
Yes. I had noticed that the company was, in as a whole, very gender balanced. Now, it started with gender awareness, I would say, because I had become a mother a few years before, and I had it got me thinking, you know, how do I raise my son? My first child was a son. How do I raise a son and have him not reproduce the kind of behaviors I don't like or I suffer from as a woman? And then I gave birth to a daughter. More questions arose, you know, what can I do to help the world become a little bit more gentle to her and to other girls? It got me take a critical eye at the system in which I worked. And I realized that from a global pool of talent that was very gender balanced, about 50-50 among the overall workforce, less and less women were present in decision-making bodies as you rose, you know, through the ranks.
Mm.
The higher the position, the less women. And I thought, why? There's no reason. The workforce is equally, you know, is all educated, and there should be no rational explanation for that. So that means there's something else. And at first, I took it as a personal issue, you know, like, oh, poor me, you know, I'm a woman, so I will not climb the ladder. But then taking a closer look, I realized that no, it was a systemic issue, and it was not affecting women only, but also a lot of men. Those who were permitted to rise were men of a very specific kind. They were not representative of the whole population of men.
Uh-huh.
And so I could see that the filters at each level were extremely strong and were letting go only a very narrow kind of personality. And I thought, these kind of people are great, but we need more than them. We need broader variety of perspectives, you know, of experiences, of life experiences, to connect with our customers, with our ecosystem. I was in business operations. I was reading. And I was getting aware of the importance of connectedness, of relatedness.
Mm-hmm.
More and more, our customers want that. They want to be listened to. They want to be understood. They want to have, you know, personalized service, et cetera, et cetera. So you can't do that if you have only a tiny, tiny fraction of the world's population represented in the command post of companies. You need a broader diversity. That's where I thought, well, maybe they haven't thought about it. It's not that they are actively trying to discourage women from rising up. You know, it's maybe they don't know how to do it. So I could suggest ideas. I've just read this report. It's super interesting. So maybe I can provide those ideas and share those ideas with the CEO. Who knows? You know, it didn't have a direct effect. The CEO didn't read my email, I think, or not at that time. He read it maybe a long time later. But it had an important effect on my own agency, and it created the possibility for connection and the possibility for collective engagement. That really was my entry into this world of community engagement, which has become my passion and the backbone of everything I do now. Again, informed by Helen's sentence, we need to strategize change from a social movement perspective.
Part 2, Taking Notes and Community Activism. Two of the seven leadership principles that I write about are collaborate with others and put others first. In this story, Celine illustrates both of those principles. Again, here's Celine.
My experience with activism in the workplace led me to create several experiments, I would say, but funded by the company to achieve a certain business result, a certain outcome, leveraging this type of dynamic, leveraging collective engagement, community engagement. The first experiment was centered around the launch of a new product and trying to engage community outside, you know, potential clients, etc. And it was very successful. It triggered a community of 250,000 people worldwide, leveraging the diversity of social networks and creating a whole new conversation around the topic which the product was addressing. So it was a big success, but internally it was a nightmare because the company was really not accustomed to creating this giant conversation. Instead of, they were very comfortable in pushing information to people. Mm-hmm. Trying to convince people to buy or to do whatever. So I was a bit discouraged at that time. But the company hired a chief quality officer. That was in 2014. This person came in and realized that the situation of our industrial quality, the way people manufactured the products, was not stable and certainly not good enough. He stumbled upon my work and thought, maybe we could do something together. This person was much higher up than I was. He reported directly to the CEO, and he approached me because he felt this my work around community engagement was interesting. I was very surprised because in my organization, you don't talk to people in, I mean, the organization I was in at that time, you don't talk to somebody from another silo without going through his or her manager.
Yes.
It's a very, very hierarchical, very traditional, you know, kind of communication interaction patterns. This guy reached out to me directly and he was curious. Again, a very interesting and unprecedented for me leadership behavior. He was curious about the skills, the expertise of somebody else lower down in the hierarchy. He invited me to come and explain to him what I was doing. He took notes. He took notes, and I was blown away that he took notes, which seems ridiculous. Why wouldn't you take notes, you know, if somebody's telling you something? Well, again, in a hierarchical organization, to display power, you don't take notes. It's the lower down, the person lower down at a lower level that takes notes, not the higher up. Through his behaviors, he kind of broke several symbolic barriers, I would say. Not barriers between me and him, but barriers between him and a dominant leadership culture. I could see he was different from those very tiny signs. So my interest rose. He then suggested we do something together. And I said, well, I don't know anything about quality. You know, I'm a marketing commercial operations person. I have absolutely no knowledge in quality. But then he said, no problem. I don't need your whatever expertise in quality. I have it. And I have experts and professionals who have it. But I need your expertise with people engagement. And there was the beginning of a wonderful journey that lasted 4 years that brought me to the US for a wonderful position. We created together this position called Head of Innovation and Engagement for Quality. It was a very unique, I searched on LinkedIn that day when we found that wording, and among 350 million professionals, no one had this title. So it was a very unique creation from connecting our two expertises, which were very different. By finding a point of connection, we were able to invent, create, and innovate. This position, so my role, was to transform quality from an imposed constraint on people to a shared passion. Wow, tell me about a challenge. Transforming quality into a passion is quite something. Usually it's not the kind of topic that triggers passion or whatever feeling, except, you know, it's supposed to trigger compliance, not passion. And yet that's what we set to do. I leveraged the tools, the techniques, the everything I'd learned previously in my previous engagements, previous experiments, always remembering what Helen said. We need to strategize change from a social movement perspective. So how could we create a social movement in the workplace around this topic? We got to work with Professor John Cotter, leading experts in change and the author of many books. And we got to use the social networks internally. Back to that person's behaviors, the little signs I mentioned in the beginning were complemented by others. This person accepted to learn and to try new things. For example, he accepted me to teach him about Twitter, to open a Twitter account. He accepted me. So, and I say accepted because it's quite significant, again, in a very traditional and hierarchical culture, to have higher up accept to put himself or herself in a learning situation, in a beginner situation, in a situation where he or she can make mistakes. Those mistakes will be visible, and yet they take the risk. Well, I see very few leaders doing that.
The traditional thinking, which is command and control, or what some people call C2 or C-squared is what they call it. The ideas come from the top, but it's what I find fascinating is that here's a situation where someone recognizes the ideas don't necessarily, yes, I bring something to the table and I bring ideas and perspective, but to really grow.
Yes.
To reach a strategic destination, you need to encompass the thoughts and innovation and creativity of people who are closer to the work, who have a broader understanding. It sounds like this chief has tapped into you.
Yes. Yes. And we together tapped into the knowledge and the passion of everybody else. We created something that was quite unique that managed to solve problems that had not been solved for 15 years, because for 15 years we had tried to push solutions at people. We had tried to change people, to change how they work, how they think, how they behave, etc. But together we reversed that in a way, and together with Cotter as well, we instead engaged people into co-creating quality and engagement and collaboration, etc. It seems obvious when you say it, but it was a radical, almost a revolution in such a controlled, constrained and regulated company. So it makes me think if we did it, anyone can do it. So there's no excuse. If more companies are not doing that, it's not because they can't. It's because they suffer from a lack of imagination, probably, but also from a lack of courage. It takes courage. I must recognize it takes courage from leadership to really invite people in the creation of collective solutions, rather than it's really easy to tell other people from, you know, higher up what to do. But it's more challenging to invite the collective into co-creating the future. And yet it is so much more beneficial to the business and to the people.
There's a word that describes what you and the chief quality officer were doing, and the word is almost. Out of context, that makes no sense. But let me give you the context. There's a brilliant performance consultant named Gary Rumler who had a quotation which has become quite famous, and it's this: if you pit a good performer against a bad system, the system will win almost every time.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah.
You and this chief went up against this structure, this system, and became the almost. You found a way to change the structure and empowered yourself and other people to make a difference, to engage them and bring out their creativity about improving, strengthening quality and what you do.
Yes. And we did that with minimal changes to the structure itself.
Yeah.
And instead with a lot of work on the identity, on our collective identity. Who were we? What were we trying to achieve, etc.? This work, this conversation was not done in a boardroom among, you know, executives. It was done with everybody, shop floor workers, middle managers, etc. It's by inviting everybody from the very start, from the starting point even, you know, not by trying to engage people at the very end of a process. It's too late. We have not created authorship and ownership. So here our process, actually the process was even more important than the solutions. It's how we engage people that created the sense of community, a sense of togetherness, a sense of activism, which changed everything.
Part 3, Nurturing Collective Capacity and the Quality of the Process. Celine offers us some advice that aligns with those three leadership principles I mentioned earlier: connect with others, collaborate with others, and put others first. Here's Celine with her advice.
My advice is to take a step back from your own solutions. It's to free people from your own solutions. So take a step back, make space for others. Try to establish conditions for a collective solution to happen. It's sometimes not easy because you're tempted to, you know, come up with your expertise. You know what should happen, but you know from your own point of view. You don't know from the system point of view. If you want systemic improvement, you need the whole system to be on board. You need to complement your own perspective by those of others. The others need to be on board from the very beginning. So how do you create this collective capacity? How do you nurture collective capacity? I think it's by taking a step back, but not like, you know, letting go and, oh my God, what will I do? Am I becoming useless or what? No. It's about paying more attention to the process than to the solution, because the solution depends on the process. The quality of the solution depends on the quality of the process. So how do you reach a solution? It's by engaging those people, and by engaging, not by imposing, you know, convening a meeting in the border. No. It's by creating willingness, joy, pleasure, connection, this togetherness in action, creating the possibility for people to connect in diversity with each other and with you as well. It's not by staying above that you will be able to change anything. It's by coming down, stepping down from our pedestal of leaders, maybe, and instead engaging in enabling community, a sense of community and solidarity, creating a possibility for people to rely on their own agency in connection with the agency of others.
And that includes having multiple-way conversations, not a one-way, but not a two-way.
Yeah.
But multiple voiced conversation. And when you do that, you enable other people to lead in thinking. The role of those who are not leading and thinking at that particular moment, it's inquiring and learning, and then someone else, and it leads some, and then another person.
Yes. And respecting others' differences. For example, some people may not be comfortable in public conversations, for example. They may not have the same level of education, and yet they all bring something unique and important.
My thanks to Celine Schillinger. If you'd like to learn more about Celine, go to the show notes. I'd like to thank you for listening. This is Gary DePaul. Until next time, lead on.